From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, Iraqi militants lay siege to the country's largest oil refinery after Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki fires some of his military commanders. We get the latest from Iraq.
I think heads had to roll, but right now it's about consolidating force and then pushing back against the ISIS advances.
Also today, the Iranians dig in their heels at nuclear talks in Vienna. Leonardo DiCaprio launches an impassioned plea to save the world's oceans. And what Hillary Clinton says about the US presidency to interviewers outside the United States.
The job is almost indescribably difficult. People have to say something to the press, whether we've thought through what the implications are or not.
That's ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The U.S. military is acknowledging that it has received a formal request from Iraqi President Nouri al-Maliki for airstrikes against the insurgent ISIL group. So far, the Obama administration has rejected the requests, but U.S. President Barack Obama is expected to meet with congressional leaders to discuss the next steps for Iraq. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has an update.
The chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, confirmed to a Senate panel the U.S. military does have a formal request from the Iraqi government for air power. But so far, the Obama administration has only indicated it is considering options and has not committed to airstrikes. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said he does not support in any way American troops getting involved in Iraq's civil war. And yet, with the attack on Iraq's largest oil refinery and with major corporations, including Exxon and British Petroleum, evacuating staff, and reports that ISIS is inching closer to Baghdad, it's becoming clear that Iraq needs help sooner rather than later.
Libya has slammed a U.S. military operation to capture the suspected ringleader behind an attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi in 2012. Libya says the raid on the 15th of June near Benghazi to capture Ahmed Abu Qatala amounted to a violation of its sovereignty. Nina Maria Potts reports.
The capture of jihadist leader Ahmed Abu Qatala, 2 years after the U.S. ambassador was killed in an attack in Benghazi, has sparked questions over why it took so long. He was captured in a raid by U.S. special forces at his home on June the 15th and swiftly removed from Libya. Now the Obama administration is under attack, especially from Republicans, over why it took so long. And in Libya, too, recriminations over what diplomats are calling a violation of their country's sovereignty. There are denials that the Libyan authorities had been informed of the operation, with Libya's justice minister saying he stressed the right to try Abu Qatala on Libyan territory under Libyan law.
In a landmark ruling, the U.S. Patent Office has invalidated trademarks for the name of Washington's Redskins American football team. The board said the name is disparaging of Native Americans, something activists have been saying for years. Lorna Shattuck has more.
Campaigners have been working towards this moment for a long time with limited success, but finally a ruling in their favour. Now the Redskins football team doesn't have to change its name, but this will have an impact on their profits from merchandising sales. The case was filed on behalf of five Native Americans who found the Redskins nickname offensive and outdated. As the campaign gained momentum, some leading figures in US sports and in government have urged a name change, but Washington Redskins owner Dan Snyder has made it clear that he's not interested in a switch.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, is proposing a unilateral ceasefire in the east of the country to allow pro-Russian separatists to disarm. It's the first step in the president's peace plan aimed at curtailing unrest in the Donbass region. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
A ceasefire will be implemented shortly, Petro Poroshenko said in a statement, to give the rebel units a chance to disarm and Russian mercenaries wishing to leave the country to do so. The Ukrainian president promised an amnesty for fighters who lay down arms and those who have not committed grave crimes. The announcement came after a phone conversation between President Poroshenko and Russian President Vladimir Putin on the situation in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian rebels have been fighting government troops since April. Mr. Poroshenko's peace plan also includes the release of hostages, the liberation of buildings occupied by rebels, and the drafting of constitutional amendments on power decentralization.
And a German newspaper has reported that German arms maker Rheinmetall is close to inking a $3.7 billion deal to move an entire weapons factory to Algeria. Despite public opposition to selling arms to authoritarian governments, the North African country is the largest recipient of German weapons. Ira Spitzer reports from FSN's bureau in Berlin.
Germany has been exporting weapons to Algeria since 2008, but this is the first time the weapons would actually be produced there. The agreement, reported by the German newspaper Handelsblatt, would be to produce 980 armored vehicles over about 8 years. It would be part of a broader and potentially controversial agreement between German companies and Algeria worth over $13 billion that would also include weapons made by the firms Daimler and ThyssenKrupp. As part of the deal, the Algerian government would promise not to resell the vehicles.
For the rest of the day's news, you can follow us on Twitter at Feature Story. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
We've sent our Kurdish security forces to fill the void that has been left by the Iraqi security services that left their posts. We are seeing the conflict moving away from Kurdistan. The conflict target seems to be Baghdad.
Kubad Talabani, the deputy prime minister of Kurdistan in northern Iraq. He told reporters today he believes the country has now fallen apart as a unitary state. Today, Sunni militants laid siege to Iraq's biggest oil refinery at Beji, 170 miles north of Baghdad. The Iraqi government claims its forces repulsed the attack, but at least some parts of the refinery were reportedly under militant control. As President Obama met with congressional leaders to discuss America's next moves in Iraq, witnesses on the ground say events there continue to move very quickly. Michael Stevens is the deputy director of Britain's Royal United Services Institute, an independent think tank. And he's in Iraq.
I think the most important thing right now actually is for Maliki to consolidate what forces he has that are still high morale, they're loyal, they are looking to push back against the ISIS offensive. Yes, I think that there were one or two commanders, particularly in Northern Command, who are responsible for some pretty shameful behavior from the Iraqi army and have left many soldiers who were determined to fight without orders and without commands. I think there had to be a lot of introspection from the Iraqi state as to why that happened. So I think heads had to roll. But right now it's about consolidating force and then pushing back against the ISIS advances.
Latest reports suggest, Michael, ISIS are now just 35 miles or so from the capital, Baghdad. Your best place to give us the latest on that. Is the capital, are Iraqi forces prepared? And also, how are ordinary Iraqis coping?
Yeah, there is quite a lot of preparation that's been going on, both in terms of Iraqi army coalescing all of their forces around the area of Baghdad. That began to happen about a week ago as the prime minister realized that ISIS was pushing south. I don't expect that ISIS will have the military capability to take Baghdad. Average citizens, it really depends on what part of the country you're talking about. Some are extremely nervous. Some are unsure as to where the country is going to go. I think a few have accepted that perhaps they may have to leave the country for good. Others are very ideologically committed to fighting ISIS. I think most, however, have expressed deep disappointment with the way that the government has handled things and would like a better response from their government, not just in the military sphere, but also in terms of social provisions and making Iraqis feel like they are part of one country again. In the north of the country, the Kurds are obviously taking the advantage right now to enforce security in their region, and I think that they will try and establish some kind of security zone whereby that their interests are met and the Sunni and Shia further south will keep fighting. At the moment, I think the conflict will probably heat up very much in the next 2 or 3 days.
Michael Stevens, the deputy director of the British think tank, the Royal United Services Institute. He is in Iraq and he was talking there to Lisa Aziz of LBC Radio. Meantime, in Vienna, Iran dug in its heels today at nuclear talks that have also seen sideline discussions take place with US officials over Iraq. The Iranians said today they won't significantly cut the number of centrifuges they use to produce nuclear fuel, a position that could torpedo the talks. FSN's Europe correspondent Sandra Gutman is in Vienna covering the talks. Sandra, is a compromise with the West on these nuclear issues now seeming less likely?
Well, some of the most divisive issues remain to be tackled. And of course, these negotiations might see those approached more seriously towards the end of the last round of talks before that July 20 deadline. For now, it does seem, according to remarks made this evening by Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Zarif, that work has begun on starting to draft what is to become the final agreement. So we are seeing some progress in this fifth round of talks after the last round saw talks flop over one of the divisive issues that remain between Iran and Western nations, which is the number of centrifuges the regime is prepared to cut down. Now, it's developed over 19,000, and the U.S. particularly wants that figure to drop closer to the hundreds. So obviously, a huge gap still remains in that aspect. The U.S. also wants to make sure that there is lasting monitoring of Iran's nuclear activities beyond a final deal. And Washington also wants Iran to reduce its level of enriched uranium to levels much less than Iran is prepared to give into. In exchange, Iran really wants to see economic sanctions lifted and not phased out as the West is proposing it might do, but really more or less all at once. So obviously these remain huge sticking points, and more analysts are saying that that July 20 deadline is appearing less and less feasible.
So what do you think we'll see by the end of the week when this round of talks is scheduled to close?
Well, the hope is that by Friday, some form of a workable draft will be in place. Whether that's a few lines or simply an introduction, we don't know yet. But what we do know is that process has indeed begun on Wednesday afternoon here in Vienna. Now, that's more than many expected, but we did hear remarks from Iranian officials on Tuesday evening that that was their hope. And this really provides a springboard for the more difficult negotiations still to come. I think when there is something on paper, all sides can agree that things can be tweaked and can agree on what to include in that final draft. Now, obviously, this process is still slow. There have been huge delays in even trying to get to this stage of drafting. But I think many see this as a positive step. And come Friday, many are expecting that a workable, at least, framework can be agreed on.
FSN's Sandra Gutman, our Europe correspondent in Vienna today. This is FSN Reports.
I'm going to use my authority as president to protect some of our most precious marine landscapes, just like we do for mountains and rivers and forests. These are just a few of the steps the United States is taking to keep our oceans strong and healthy.
President Obama announcing there that he's creating the world's largest marine protected area in the South Central Pacific Ocean. The president, facing obstacles in the U.S. Congress to any kind of meaningful environmental initiatives, is increasingly turning to executive orders in a bid to create some kind of a green legacy. His announcement came at a conference on the world's oceans held this week at the State Department. And that conference also heard yesterday from the Hollywood actor Leonardo DiCaprio in his capacity as the head of the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation. He pledged an additional $7 million in support to ocean conservation projects, and he made a passionate speech about the urgent need for action. Here's some of it.
Now, before I wanted to be an actor, I dreamt about becoming a marine biologist. As a kid, I always had a fascination with the ocean and its wildlife. In fact, the first philanthropic dollar I ever contributed was to save the wild manatee in Florida. I'd never seen a manatee before, but I somehow felt connected to the plight of these animals who had no voice and no ability to save themselves from the devastation caused by human activity. Today, I feel just as connected and inspired by ocean life that covers most of our planet. As an avid diver, I've been fortunate enough to experience some of the most pristine and wild places on Earth. From my very first dive in the Great Barrier Reef to the Galapagos to Mozambique, Belize, and the islands of Thailand. And just last year, I got to visit Cocos Island, a national park off the shores of Costa Rica, where I had the opportunity to swim with 15 different species of shark, white tips, tiger sharks, and hammerheads in one of the world's largest natural shark sanctuaries. And I came out unscathed. These experiences haven't just been adventures, they've been educational for me. They've taught me just how fragile these ecosystems really are. Since my very first dive in the Great Barrier Reef in Australia 20 years ago, to the dive I got to do in the very same location just 2 years ago, I've witnessed environmental devastation firsthand. What once had looked like an endless underwater utopia is now riddled with bleached coral reefs and massive dead zones. Recently, on the Cocos Island dive, we stayed inside a marine protected area where it was technically illegal to hunt sharks or other marine life within 10 miles of the sanctuary. But every night, we hopelessly watched illegal fishing vessels invade the waters just 1 mile offshore. I've learned that with each passing day, so many of our aquatic species are in jeopardy, not because of nature's unpredictability, but because of human activity. Growing up, I remember hearing stories about the seemingly endless bounty that our oceans had to offer. How fishermen would cast a net 100 years ago and catch 10-foot-long tuna or 18-foot-long sturgeon. It seemed like nothing would ever challenge the abundance the sea had to offer. But today, we live in a very different reality. Because of modern industrialized fishing, ships are heading into ever deeper waters in search of decent catch, only to find ever dwindling stocks. We have systematically devastated our global fisheries through destructive practices like bottom trolling, where huge nets drag across the bottom of the ocean for miles, literally scraping up everything in their path, permanently destroying abundant underwater forests teeming with every imaginable form of wildlife. I want to acknowledge the fact that significant commitments have been announced here over the last day to forward ocean protection. But this is just the beginning. We need to do much more to scale these commitments globally, continuously building more urgency and momentum to match the magnitude of this massive global challenge. It's the Wild West on the high seas. The ocean is an under-regulated marketplace right now, even though the ocean covers 71% of our planet. Less than 1% are fully protected as marine reserves where fishing is prohibited. These last remaining underwater biogems are being destroyed because there isn't proper enforcement or sufficient cooperation among governments to protect them. People who depend on these ocean's resources for sustenance need to hear that governments are working to create strong systems of accountability for those who are destroying it. If we don't do something to save our oceans now, it won't be just the sharks and the dolphins that will suffer. It will be all of us, including our children and our grandchildren.
Leonardo DiCaprio speaking at the Oceans Conference at the US State Department in Washington, D.C. Next tonight, FSN Spotlight and the interview with Hillary Clinton that you almost certainly have not heard. While the former First Lady has been ubiquitous on US television and radio, talking up her new memoir, Hard Choices, ahead, of course, of the hardest choice of all, whether to seek the US presidency, she has also been making global headlines. And so her media tour has included a couple of prominent overseas broadcasters. So today, we thought it would be interesting to hear the message that Mrs. Clinton presents internationally and also hear the questions she's asked. She speaks here with Peter Mansbridge, anchor of The National, the highly regarded nightly newscast on Canada's CBC.
So we're, you know, incredibly grateful that you've chosen to come here after a week of interviews to really finally tell everybody what exactly you're going to do, whether or not... Saving it for Canada is quite something.
Well, you know, we have a very close relationship, so I'm happy to be here. Both my husband and I have loved coming to Canada. He has spent a lot of time here since he left the White House, and I have accepted every invitation that I possibly could for the same reason. It's a beautiful country. We have a lot in common. There's more we can do together, so it's a welcome opportunity for
me. But in spite of all those things, this isn't going to be the place where you declare whether or not you're running for president.
I'm not ready to do that anywhere, so don't take it personally, please.
I mean, you did in 2008.
Yes.
What's really changed for you since 2008 that you wouldn't want to be in?
Well, it's such a highly personal decision. Our politics have gotten even more difficult. Trying to get things done is harder now than it was even six, 7 years
ago. But you don't shy away from those challenges.
No, I don't.
You talk about your hard choices.
I do.
Your book previous talked about hard choices.
That's right. That's right. And at the end, in the epilogue, I say, look, you know, the two most important questions for anybody running for president are not will you run and can you win, but what's your vision for the country and can you lead us there? I take that very seriously. Having run once, having been in the White House with my husband, having now worked very closely with President Obama, and even, frankly, working with George W. Bush after 9/11 because I was a senator from New York, the job is almost indescribably difficult. I mean, we have a head of state, a head of government all rolled up into one. 24/7 media has made decision-making force. People have to say something to the press, whether we've thought through what the implications are or not. The political divide that has grown up. So I want to take my time because it really comes down to what your gut is telling you.
Obviously, many people of both genders want you to run. But there is enormous pressure from women for you to run.
Yes.
They see you as the choice, the best choice.
Mm-hmm.
You have that famous question that was asked to you, you know, if not you, who?
Well, I would say this. I'm well aware of that. I'm incredibly touched by it and feel responsible because of it. And I know that it's important that we break that highest and hardest glass ceiling. I also believe there are quite a few women who are eminently qualified, but may not have the profile. Oh, a lot of the women senators, we have a couple of, you know, women governors. I'm talking on the Democratic side. So we have a good bench, so to speak. But they haven't gone through the fire. And part of the reason why there's a big drumbeat for me to run is because I've done it. I was the first woman to win a political primary in the United States. We got those 18 million votes, which represent the cracks in the glass ceiling. So people know that I'm ready, I can do the job, I have no questions about, you know, qualifications, all of that. And therefore, I think they see me as someone who just has to make up her mind and get going. But there are a lot of other women who are eminently qualified, in my opinion, to be president.
I want to talk about a number of the issues that you've already hinted at that are facing America today in terms of decisions that it has to make. And first on the front burner, suddenly, in the last week, is Iraq once again.
Right.
You talk about Iraq in the book, mainly in terms of how badly you feel about the decision you made in 2002 mm-hmm. in supporting the war. And one has to wonder after the last week, as we've seen to watch Iraq crumbling in front of our very eyes, whether as bad as the decision may have been to go into Iraq, the decision to leave Iraq, which you were a part of, was almost as bad, if not as bad.
Well, I disagree with that, Peter. I think that the decision for the United States to leave Iraq was put into motion before President Obama took office. President George W. Bush understood that there had to be a timetable that the Iraqis could look toward. When President Obama came in, there's no doubt that he was against the war, you know, very vocally. That was one of the big issues in our primary campaign. But he was very attentive, because I was in those meetings, as you say, to determining what would come next.
Was the picture that's being painted now painted in those meetings, this possibility?
Well, the Iraqis never agreed to the conditions they had to agree to for us to stay. For our troops to remain in Iraq in the numbers that we were talking about would have required something called a status of forces agreement. And that's what we have all over the world. It protects our soldiers. It provides certain immunities that they are entitled to because they're there at the invitation of a government. There was an enormous amount of effort put in to persuading Maliki to agree to a status of forces agreement. He would not do so. He wanted a lot of American sophisticated weaponry like fighter jets and, you know, sophisticated intelligence equipment, but he didn't want to agree to troops.
Is the bottom line that Maliki has to go, that he has botched this?
Well, the bottom line is he was just reelected. His party was just reelected, and I think that was...
But it could be toppled.
That was a good news, bad news story, right? I have made clear that I would not support any effort by the United States to back up his government unless the conditions we had been asking for a number of years were finally met. My attitude is whether you approved of or didn't approve of the Bush action in the beginning, the United States did its best to give the people of Iraq a different future, but we can't stage manage what they do. There was still an enormous amount of effort put in to try to convince Maliki to build a more inclusive representative government, and now they're going to have to fight for it.
Does the fighting include U.S. ground forces?
No, absolutely not.
So it's airstrikes only?
Well, not even that necessarily.
As far as you would be concerned?
I would not support any action unless there was a very clear understanding of what Maliki would or wouldn't do, who was running the army, and what third parties were going to be involved.
But can all that happen in a matter of days?
Sometimes,
to make it sound like they're on the march, that Baghdad could fall at almost any time.
I think that the outlook for that is somewhat more hopeful than it was just a few days ago, because they have rallied their forces in and around Baghdad. But sometimes it takes an emergency to focus the mind. I mean, before I left the Secretary of State's job, I had yet another conversation with Maliki. And you know, one of our problems with moving from dictatorships like Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi to incipient, embryonic democracies is that no one has that experience. And when you are inexperienced and you are required to make tough, hard choices, very often you fall back on what's most familiar. That can be religious identity, clan identity, tribal identity, personal connections, corruption as a means for getting things done. There is no training ground. These leaders, often they're former guerrillas, former insurgents, former exiles, former hard men, and they then find themselves in positions of responsibility without any real understanding of how a democracy is supposed to work. I mean, that's the problem we ran into with Morsi in Egypt. What an opportunity he had to show that, you know, Muslim Brotherhood could actually govern like they said they were going to try to do, and slowly over time, purges, accusations. There is just a fallback position of differentiation, of, you know, you must be my enemy because you're not like me. And that takes a lot of time and, frankly, heartbreak and maybe bloodshed to get through.
That's the first part of Hillary Clinton's interview with Canada's CBC. She was talking there with Peter Mansbridge. He's the host of The National every evening on CBC television. And we'll have more of that interview tomorrow. If you can't wait till then, you can see the encounter in its entirety on the CBC website, www.cbc.ca. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. I'm Simon Marks in Washington for everyone with Feature Story News everywhere. Have a great evening. We'll see you tomorrow. Goodbye.